Hi, you are listening to the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. This podcast is for policymakers, governments, researchers, students, businesses, and anyone that is interested in conflict and development issues in Africa. On this podcast, we hear from experts from across Africa and the world. Your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa, will ask the questions you would want answers to. Michael Wangpa has an extensive experience spanning over a decade studying, researching, writing, and consulting on conflict and development issues in Africa.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. I am your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa. Today, we're going to be discussing a very important topic, human rights advocacy in Africa, looking at the progress made so far, the challenges, and the path forward. Today, I'm joined by a very special guest, Mrs. Adeshola Adeboyejo. Mrs. Adeboyejo is an international lawyer. She's the director at the Center for African Justice, Peace and Human Rights based in Hague, Netherlands. She has served many years as a counsel and prosecutor at the International Criminal Court, the UN International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, and many other services that she's rendered to international law. Adeshola, you've had a very impressive resume and experience and as an international lawyer and prosecutor. We're very delighted to have you join us today in the podcast.
Thank you very much, Dr. Wangpa. It's my delight also to be here with you. Thank you for inviting me.
You're welcome. Let me start from this. It is the responsibility of a sovereign state to protect the rights of its citizens. But sometimes, often than not, when states then become the violator of such rights, or when they are incapable of doing that, that responsibility sometimes shifts to other actors, maybe at the regional level or the international community. So over the years, we've seen the establishment of some legal instruments or that have, to protect these rights of individuals in society. We've seen the Universal Declaration of Human Rights after the Second World War. We've seen on the continent the African Charter on Human and People's Rights. And we've seen, the ICC as well. So in your opinion, how effective are these instruments, in protecting human rights in Africa in the last 50 to 60 years since most African countries gained independence?
Thank you very much. Well, I would say that Africa has been making some progress in terms of allowing these human rights instruments to influence the way and manner in which they conduct their affairs. If you look at the fact that now, for example, we have the African Charter on Human and People's Rights. We have the African Charter on the Rights and Welfare of the Child. And we have, quite a number of other universal human rights instruments that African countries have become a part of. They've either acceded to, they've ratified. You can see that the African states have made, significant progress in trying as much as possible to ensure that they integrate these relevant provisions of international human rights treaties into their national laws to ensure that these instruments are more binding, to ensure that they are able to use these instruments to protect the rights of the citizens, whether it's women's rights, whether it's rights of the child, or whether it's even in terms of judicial reforms. We can see that there's some progress that has been made across the African continent. We are not, of course, perfect yet, but certainly we've made quite some progress.
Okay, that's interesting to note. Looking at them, I agree. We've made a certain progress, but like you said, if I follow up, you say we're not perfect. So what are those areas where there are still challenges that you've identified across the continent, and what needs to be done in those areas?
Well, you find out that with some of these African states, there are challenges because they're also developing in their nationhood. There are still things that they need to streamline, sometimes even in terms of the way and manner in which they go about the implementation of some of these instruments that I've been talking about. It's still, you still have that some of the African states are still having challenges in terms of how the conflict, in terms of insecurity, in terms of even how you are able to, as international bodies are able to get information with regards to how they investigate or how they prosecute cases. There are still challenges with some of the African countries in terms of even their ability to be able to allow civil society or civil society organizations to operate as freely as they should or they would. So there are still some of these teething problems, but as I said before, I don't want it to be to something that in broad strokes would say, oh, they're not doing well. I still believe that there's still a lot has been done, but a lot can still be done and will be done as they grow stronger.
I agree with you. I share your optimism. And speaking of that, you mentioned something about there are two things that I was going to pull up on the conflict and insecurity. But I wanted to talk about where the way you described most African countries are still developing.
Yeah.
So if I look at that and I then look at in the last 60 years, I think. Many African countries gained independence at least in the last 60 years or thereabouts.
That's right.
There's been some progress, but then again, there's been issues that also border around that nationhood that you mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
That challenges, mm-hmm. you know, the establishment of that nationhood, and usually people look at this in terms of like the history, the colonial history. The history of state formation that is hampering, you know, the formation of that strong nationhood.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if I link it to the current, you know, we've seen in the Francophone countries, we've seen some kind of like, to be honest, to be fair, I say it's kind of worldwide, even in Western developed worlds, we see some kind of backsliding in democracy. But in Africa, it's kind of a bit peculiar. In the Francophone countries, we see a new this anti-French sentiment and all of that.
Mm-hmm.
So if I bring it to the work of the work that you have done, bringing home to like the establishment of the International Criminal Court,
mm-hmm.
and look at how that has been an effective intervener in the continent, how that also creates that perception of or relieves that history, that colonial history. I don't know if I'm making sense with I don't know if you understand where I'm going to.
Well,
so I'm saying how effective, yeah, go on.
Go ahead. Okay.
Yeah, so how effective is the International Criminal Court in mediating, you know, bearing in mind these histories of and this new development that is going on?
Well, I think I will start with the caveat that I am not in a position to speak directly, as I'm sure you're aware, for the courts. So my views are actually as strictly personal. But I would say that by and large, the court has done quite a bit in terms of, you know, assisting the especially the African states to assist them in terms of their justice mechanisms. And why do I say this? They've been able to assist with the issue, for example, of capacity building, which I think has been something that for a while with African states, something that has been, you know, useful in terms of their interaction, strengthening their knowledge base, providing resources to civil society organizations, assisting with trainings. That's been quite significant. And also just in terms of just encouraging legal and institutional reforms, you know, both at national levels, ensuring that, you know, that there's some measure of compliance with international human rights standards, and just ensuring that, you know, the accountability mechanisms are strengthened, because there's a lot, of course, that, you know, you can say that we can still provide support in some other areas. There are still areas that are still open for engagement that can be had with these local communities. But by and large, I would say that in terms of the involvement of the ICC, there has been, we've moved away from where we started, and we are at a stronger point now in terms of the engagement between the ICC and a lot of these African countries.
If I take upon that, because if you look at so in the light of let's say there's this the AU's 2063 agenda, and the idea that you know, African solutions for African problems, which if I look at that in, I don't know if that also is a conversation that, if we can put within that during the establishment of ICC, and look at how, maybe look at, I think there were two similar courts at the continent. I think there was one in Rwanda, and there was one in whether Sierra Leone, if I'm not wrong. So if I look at all of this, why, how effective are these? Are these courts parallel to the ICC? Why are they parallel? Are they independent? And why, how effective have they been? And why couldn't they be? Why do cases have to still come to ICC if we have this court? Are these courts still useful? You've worked in this, you know, I think you've worked in Rwanda as well, and you've worked in ICC. So how do you explain? Are they duplicate instruments?
No, not at all. The court in Rwanda was a UN court that was set up specifically to address the conflict situation in Rwanda, and so also the court in Sierra Leone. The difference was that these were courts that were set up, these were the courts that were set up at the mandate of the UN, specifically for those conflict situations. So they were not parallel, so to speak, to the ICC. The ICC came in later as a treaty-based organization, because there was a growing recognition that instead of having this, as it were, ad hoc, and you know, those courts were specifically referred to as being the ad hoc courts, that they should have, or that we should have, a streamlined court that actually deals with this, and would be a court that has more or less universal jurisdiction and can address conflicts that take place in almost every part of the world. rather than on an ad hoc basis. And so the court in Rwanda has moved from its active phase. Now you have what you call the residual mechanism, which is just taking its handling cases that are still within the dockets that are more or less left over. Most of the cases have been concluded. Some were handed over back to the Rwandan government to oversee. And so it's winding up pretty much of what the work that it has done. Same with the Sierra Leone tribunal. But whereas with the ICC, it's been set up actually to continue to endure as a lasting legacy of the decision of the entire international community to have a court that addresses these kinds of egregious crimes against humanity, as well as war crimes. So there's a distinction between the ICC and these other ad hoc tribunals.
Okay, that's a clear decision. But why can these courts? I'm just saying where the question will come in. How truly international is the? This is just a bit of just following up from what you've mentioned. If we're to have a court that is universal that looks at issues beyond even Africa, but it does seem from his history of persecution at the ICC, he does have that feeling that I was an interview with the chief prosecutor at ICC, Bento Fatsuda, and then where he, about the ICC being alleged to have a bias towards African leaders that have been accused of human rights, whereas compared to other places where you've seen leaders do that, ICC have not successfully prosecuted them. Do you share that that sentiment?
Well, first of all, it must have been an old report you watched, because she's no longer a prosecutor. She was, but now the new prosecutor is Karim Khan. But coming to your question, it's actually now an old narrative, to be very honest with you. This whole question or the perception that the ICC was primarily targeting African leaders for prosecution. Mm-hmm. Especially if you think about the fact that if you look at the docket of the ICC now, they've opened investigations into the conflict in Ukraine. The prosecutor has been, making strides in terms of ensuring that investigations are also being opened for crimes that are committed outside of Africa. So it's not the case anymore that you can say that the ICC has is focusing only on cases against African states. And then don't forget that in any case, most of those cases that were initiated through referrals from the African governments themselves. They were the ones that brought about the self-referral. I mean, I still remember very, very clearly that with regards to the Kenyan cases, for example, the Kenyans themselves had a slogan, don't be vague, go to Hague. So it was African countries. Uganda sent the first cases to the ICC. So those early cases had come from the African states themselves. And then I think also because the perception had come because there was a lot of those cases involved high profile persons in African leaders, and so there was a lot of media publicity around it, and that gave a very disproportionate view that the African leaders were being targeted, whereas you know it wasn't it wasn't really the facts, but what had actually happened was it was just a result of the evolution of the court. But as I said earlier, what's important is to understand that the court's mandate was to address most serious crimes of international concern, and that was a lot of those conflicts in Africa, you know, fell within that mandate, and they were being tackled by the court as was its duty to do, and now that the ICC has opened preliminary investigations in regions outside Africa, I believe that this is to show its commitment to global accountability, and that narrative doesn't hold anymore.
I think I agree with you, and I would say I agree with you because the only reason, like you pointedly described, it's Africa had that disproportionate focus on it, because Africa, unfortunately, I think after the post-Cold War, experienced a lot of like civil wars, and it was bound to have all this kind of human rights violation, because you know we're experiencing so many kind of atrocities that are leading to injustice. But there's something you mentioned now in terms of self-referral and African government themselves referring. So in terms of, and I want to link that also to the UN missions across Africa. We've seen in Mali where the Kunta government has sacked the UN mission there and asked them to leave. We also see, I think we've seen in Congo recently and in other places. So it does seem to me like, for instance, when government themselves, like if I come back to the question I was asking before, when governments, and then this also comes to issue of in the international law, which I think you'd be the best position to explain further, where sovereignty, sometimes people, the sovereign states sometimes, you know, hide behind the principle of non-intervention and sovereignty. And then how does courts like international criminal courts, how do you reconcile that dilemma where, let's say, people within these states where the governments are abusive, how do they have access to courts? Because once they don't have access, then it's easy to resort to violence. How do they, if the government has to be the one to refer itself, how do people within civil society within that state access or bring that government to account?
Well, the issue of complementarity is one of the kernels of the ICC's regime. It's very important for us to understand that it's not only that a state can refer a matter to the ICC, but also that the prosecutor himself also has the powers, even though there are guidelines as to how he can use those powers to also have a matter come before the ICC for investigation and for a prosecution to also commence. But having said that, I think that you also made the point that we have to understand that the state's sovereignty has to be respected. And I think that's where the whole issue of complementarity, that's why it was also enshrined in the Rome Statute, that you have to be certain that the country is unable and unwilling to carry out those prosecutions before you can then ask the ICC to step in. And I think that it is important that we also see that states are seen to, even if they have some kind of conflict or even if they have some kind of instability, that there is some kind of constructive engagement with the state to be able to be sure that they have justice mechanisms that can sustain their attempts to find a domestic solution to the problem before the ICC is engaged to actually then step in and begin investigations in order to carry out any kind of prosecutions. So it's a point that you have made and which continues to be part of the engagement by the ICC with the different states to ensure that the principle of complementarity is respected and understood before any further steps are undertaken in that regard.
Yeah, there's also another unique manifestation in the continent where the atrocities are being perpetrated by state and also non-state actors. So we see, I think it was Combat Fatou Bassin as well. I think she was the one that investigated the Boko Haram and the Nigerian government, where both parties were seen to be culpable of committing grave, egregious human rights violation. How does the court deal with such non-state act groups that might look elusive and, you know?
Well, I basically it still falls within, as I explained earlier, the principle of complementarity, because if the state shows that it is able, it is willing and able within its domestic legal framework and mechanisms to still try those non-state actors, then it will go ahead and it will do so. If I give you the example, but in some other instance, the state could determine that, you know what, we don't even want to get into this. We would prefer that the ICC deals with this. So if you take the example of Uganda, for example, Uganda was willing to allow the LRA commanders to be tried by the ICC, even though it has the capacity in its own national jurisdiction to set up the mechanism for trial. And indeed, I think one of them, if I recall, Thomas Coelho, there was a whole mechanism that was set up for his trial that was ongoing. So in certain instances, the state could determine that it would prefer to refer the case to the ICC for the ICC to take it over and to conduct the investigations. But in other instances, some of the states are resistant to that, and using the principle of complementarity, they would prefer for the trials or such investigations to be carried out domestically, and then they would proceed with whatever judicial remedies they want to put into place.
But then again, I don't know if this is applicable. If you've seen this in your years of working at the formal legal level. So when it comes to Africa, there's been some. I could take the case of South Africa, for instance, where you could see, you know, the Truth to Reconciliation Committee that set up to the post apartheid stuff. People have been talking about an African court where it's not all about, I think in my last book I read, where there's a book I read where they were talking about inherited legal law that African inherited, which is a more whereas it was comparing the restorative justice system of Africa, traditional Africa, to the punitive approach of the of the Westphalian kind of like legal system. So I don't know if in your experience in working whether the Continental Court or the ICC, whether such hybrid, whether there's been an evidence of such hybrid or where, you know, they've considered looking at such kind of restorative justice.
Well, some of those African states have preferred to use the restorative justice mechanism. It's not just, we haven't had that just alone in South Africa. Gambia, for example, also decided to set up a truth commission. And I don't see, quite frankly, a contest between the two, whether it's coming to the ICC or using a restorative mechanism, because one does not necessarily preclude the other. You could have instances where you have the truth commission has been set up or restorative justice mechanism has been put in place, but it still does not preclude the fact that there are two different kinds of justice mechanism. So you don't have a situation where you have peace at the expense of justice or justice at the expense of peace. Both of them can and should actually happen. So you could have a truth mechanism, and while that is ongoing, you could also have an investigative process could start, so long as the principles and the steps that are necessary for such the referral of such, for the commencement of such investigations to be had, so long as those proper steps are undertaken, then one doesn't preclude the other.
Yeah, I do agree with you. I do agree with you with the but the way you presented it, you presented it in a way that is less contentious. But I don't know, maybe it's from your experience, but from my own experience, there's always been that kind of like dilemma where you could talk about are we going to seek peace at the expense of victim getting justice for victims?
I
was saying that in the light of my work working on Boko Haram, looking at amnesty. So I did write an article 10 years ago looking at the proposed amnesty for Boko Haram. And then if I come 10 years afterwards, looking at how they've had a government with this sort of amnesty program to Boko Haram, and how the victims feel, how the people in the community feel in terms of like how they've had a problem for those people reintegrating into those communities. So I'm looking at how do we seek peace at the expense of justice? Do we seek justice? How do we solve it? That dilemma, because it does. And then again, there's in African states, seeking justice is quite expensive. I was going to ask that question. It's quite expensive. People generally don't have access to the court or have access. So I wanted to know if, you know, follow up to that, how access to court has been, you know, how are we making, is that part of the progress? Is that part of the challenge that we're facing in the continent in terms of people accessing legal remedy?
Well, yes, you are right that there is some measure of resource constraints in terms of persons having access to justice. I think it's a it's a dilemma that every African state in one way or the other is trying to find a way to address this, whether it's in terms of capacity building for its judges, for the magistrates at various levels, or to ensure that there's some kind of infrastructure that is being made available for conducting trials, or just even educating and empowering the populace to be able to understand that it's possible for them to have access to justice. These are all the different challenges that they are facing and that can be that can be overcome in the process of trying to ensure that as much as possible efforts are made to ensure that African states address the issue of access to justice. But I think that also part of the challenge that we have is also ensuring that the states themselves, that the capacity for those judicial mechanisms to deliver justice on time is also something that needs to be addressed. You know, there are various reasons. We can't go into all of that in this short podcast, but you and I know that there are a lot of constraints that are faced, whether it's in terms of manpower, whether it's in terms of resources, whether these judicial mechanisms are adequately funded to be able to allow for, you know, the adequate access to justice. And justice is not, is time consuming. So when that whole process is going on, do we have enough resources for the common man, the average person, to be able to sustain such without having some kind of support? That definitely is a challenge that needs to be addressed, not just in Africa. I think it's a worldwide phenomenon. But of course, much more particularly for African countries, I think it's something that we need to work on.
We've also seen, I think I don't know if the call works with it also comes to like in the UK, for instance, or yeah, they have different mechanisms where the states may want to reduce the number of cases that are coming to this. Like Riley said, even in developed worlds, the resources are spreading to deal with, are limited to deal with cases. And one of the measures they've done is to see other measures. It could be mediation, it could be other kind of mechanism where certain cases can be dealt with without having to come to court. In Africa, how much is that? Is that prevalent? Is that being applied in Africa, where there are, I don't want to say pseudo kind of like court process, but some kind of alternative in between before to stop, you know, in the light of the resources?
Yes, well, for the African states in general, I'm just being general here. There are different kinds of mechanisms that are available for the states to use. If I want to use Nigeria, as you and I both know, we're now trying to decentralize and offer alternatives, whether it's in terms of, you know, alternative. But I wouldn't go so far as to say that when it comes to issues that are much more sensitive, because you mentioned Boko Haram. Those are much more sensitive because they border on issue of national security. So if we're talking about alternative dispute resolution mechanisms, you know, mechanisms at local level to resolve maybe community disputes that involve the local conflict resolution mechanisms. That's at a local level that we can talk about, that those could be available. But when there are issues that border on national security, when there are issues that border on terrorism, I think that most states are much more sensitive about those. And so they are very keen to ensure that it's either that they have the legal framework that they've already set up to handle such criminal matters, or they even set up specialized legal frameworks or criminal court systems to handle such matters, particularly because maybe they don't want those kinds of matters to be discussed openly in public, in the public public law courts.
Does ICC work with in its human rights campaign? Does it work with you mentioned like one of the ways, I think you mentioned that if I'm right, ways that ICC is helping to build capacity of the citizens in pushing the civil society organizations and education. And can you be more specific in terms of what kind of training and capacity building that the civil societies are being given to, and how that complements or how that helps the work of ICC?
Well, it's something that it has done across African countries, both in terms of educating the public. So, for example, it carries out outreach, you know, campaigns, for example, letting the public know what the work of the court is, what exactly it's going to do, because sometimes there's some resistance, maybe from the local populace, because they don't really understand what the court stands for. It's very far away from their everyday existence. They are not, they don't have enough education in terms of what it's going to bring to the table. So if I use the example of Uganda, for example, for the local population, they didn't understand why their quote-unquote son was being tried so far away in Europe. They didn't know what it was. Of course, they had all suffered from the conflict, but they didn't know the extent of what the prosecution was all about and what the court represented. But once the ICC began to engage in community outreaches, began to give them an update, let them know what was going on in court, let them have a voice, so they would ring in, they would ask questions, the questions would be answered. It gave the local population, and these questions were put to them in their local dialect, in their local language. It enabled them to understand very clearly. So it was direct. There was no intermediary. There was direct interface between the ICC in terms of its officials and the local population. And it really helped in terms of empowering the people, in terms of giving them an understanding of what the process is about and of what exactly was achieved in terms of trying to be a conflict, in trying to be part of resolving the conflict, and of course addressing some of the redresses that had happened in the past. So it's very effective, and also of course in terms of capacity building and technical assistance for some of the lawyers who are taking part in the cases that are going on locally. The ICC provides support through some of its officials going for trainings, seminars, workshops for some of these either civil society organizations or even lawyers who are directly involved in those local justice processes. And that has also been very helpful, both in terms of allowing for engagement between the ICC and you know, some of these countries, but also in increasing awareness, allowing for you know, a strengthening of the relationship with the local populace, and just generally increasing an awareness of what the ICC stands for and the capacity that the what it has brought to the table in terms of assisting in the capacity of the local population.
Okay, that's very interesting. That's interesting to know it has, you know, that broad scope of influence. But before I come to the last question, because I understand it's very early where you are, I wanted to ask, what is the scope of the activity of the Center for this African Justice, Peace and Human Rights does? Does it do similar stuff mentioned, or what is the scope of? I've just read the book that you co-edited as part of what you do. I wanted to know what is the scope of what the center does?
Well, it's very much into training, development. The book that was written was part of its capacity building initiative. It engages also in, right now it's focused on sexual violence campaign, is to shed light on sexual violence against males that is not really being talked about in the legal space. And this is something that the center has been very much in the forefront of organizing, a workshop that was very well attended by even judges from the ICC, just discussing that particular crime and how best to move the conversation forward in terms of creating awareness that this is also a particular crime that needs to be addressed in terms of international criminal justice mechanisms. So you find a situation where female sexual violence against females, there was a lot of advocacy before you found that in most prosecutions and investigations that these instances of rape, sexual violence, forced marriage was, you know, advocated and then began to be criminalized and prosecutions and convictions were entered into against perpetrators of these crimes. And so the center is trying to as it were, create awareness that this is also a crime that nobody is really, really addressing or talking about, but it needs to come out of the closet and it needs to be part of the discussion and inevitably become part of the convictions that would happen when we are talking about the prosecution of perpetrators of international crime. So both in terms of training, in terms of capacity building, in terms of creating awareness, in terms of all of these, there are different ways in which the center is doing all of this, but we're very much out there doing what we do.
That's amazing to hear. I'm glad to hear that awareness, because there's been, rightly so, there's been a more focus on sexual gender-based violence, which is usually women are typically seen, you know, and rightly so. But there's been, one of my colleagues in Birmingham has done research on Boko Haram where he's bringing out where male, like realize that there have been male victims of sexual male victims in these kind of zones. And I've just written an article for the French where I've looked at understanding women's role in this kind of conflict as well, where we can only see women as the perpetrators, where some women have shown the capacity to also be perpetrators. So I'm quite happy to hear this kind of awareness is going on. But I was going to ask to conclude, if you take like a very broad look into if you're to predict or look into the future of Africa in terms of human rights and look at the cycle of violence, which to me, I believe, you look at, you know, people calling for secession, whether, you know, recurrent issues of civil wars, it always borders on address injustices. Some of this is our historical. If you look at going forward, I take a broad outlook, what is the future? What is the path forward for Africa to be able to maybe address some of this historical injustice? How can Africa achieve a peaceful and stable, which I think in to be honest, there always be conflicts, but where do I just some relative amount of peace? How do we get those things? And how does the justice or the legal instruments play a role in facilitating a peaceful continent?
Well, the good thing is that, as I said when we started, a lot of African countries have already, in one way or the other, either they've signed up for or they've become part of a lot of these legal instruments. And I think that if they were to employ them the way that they've been framed, so it's one thing for them to be framed and for them to be in writing, it's another thing for the actualization and the actual implementation of these instruments. I mean, we, as you yourself rightly said, it seems that there will always be conflict, but we are hoping that the more that we look at the interconnectedness between maybe poverty, some of these imbalances, and some of those historical imbalances are being addressed, hopefully through some of these legal mechanisms that we have, then we would have less of these conflicts and more of a situation where legal redress can be sought for some of those historical imbalances. And when those are applied, especially with the support of the international community, then you can have a situation where there will be less conflict in Africa and things are resolved using a legal mechanism. But don't forget that this is also, I think, a developmental stage we're going through. A lot of these other parts of the developed world also went through some of these phases before they arrived in the evolution where they are now. So we will continue in this at least as much as possible, ensuring that both transitional justice mechanisms and also these other justice mechanisms are effective or effectively utilized to ensure that we have less conflict and more peaceful resolution issues of disputes or disagreements in the continent.
Wow. Thank you. I do believe that with amazing work that you're doing at the center and some of the discussion, I do share, like I said, your optimism. And look forward to a peaceful, prosperous.
So do I.
So we're very, very grateful for honoring the invitation. We thank you for. We know it's very early where you are this morning, and thank you for sharing your thoughts and opinions. We really appreciate that. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. Hi, join me in appreciating Mrs. Adeyibijo for sharing her thoughts on the human rights challenges, the progress we've made so far, and what we need to do to move forward. I trust you've learned and gained a lot, like as I've done, and I implore you to join together.